This week on the Eldritch Lorecast, I'm a little sleep deprived, a little bit luminescent there. Guiding Bolt! I give this gift to you, the light of the Eldar. I'm good.
I want to tear the system apart.
How were the goose cats?
Practically.
Please, wizards, think of these people and what they're going to have to go through to get a game together.
That's the way of the 21st century, baby.
Look at my talent.
You like these characters and you like your players and you do want to pull the punches. You don't want to see them sad.
Community outreach or community outrage? Wizards.
The people.
All that and more right now.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, the number one tabletop RPG and D&D podcast in all of the Forgotten Realms. That's right, those realms were remembered because the Eldritch Lorecast played there. My name is Ben Byrne, and I am here joined, as always, or as almost always, by James Hake, Sean Merwin, Dale Kingsmill, and Dale asking a question from friend of the show, Gethin. If you had to come up with your six ability scores for a role-playing game, what would they be?
This is what I get for not paying attention to the run sheet ahead of time. Let me think. Off the top of my head, you got to have something for lying to people. So something charisma adjacent. I don't know what I'd call it, though. Maybe social.
Just social? In general. Okay, I like that. Yep.
I kind of like having sort of athletics as its own sort of base stat, and then separate to that, something like toughness that can represent fighting or taking hits. That's only three. I need three more of them.
No, you don't.
Yeah, no, I don't. That's it. I'm done. Ha! Sean gave me permission.
Okay, no, that's fine. Sean Merwin, if you were going to create a classic 6, 4, 3, 7, what would your 21. Ability scores be?
So you know, the old adage is great minds think alike, and obviously Dale and I also think alike in the sense that I don't want six. I don't want any. I don't want any of those things anymore. Yeah. I want
He's
a simple
the system
game.
Apart.
I want to tear the system apart and put it back together in a way that we don't have to refer to too many numbers. But if I do have to make a game where we have things, we're going to keep it to three. We're going to keep, it's on my run sheet, social. Because there's talky parts of this game that we're making.
Yay!
We want the talky parts to be cool. Then there's mental, because there's smarty parts of this game that we want our characters to be. And then there's the physical, because there's hitty things that we want to do in this game, assuming we're playing a fantasy, medieval fantasy game with spells and so on. So, let's call it talky, hitty, and smarty.
I like that.
And,
perfect names.
And we are ready to go. We are ready to make our game.
I like J Pizza Beats in chat says, talking, tanking, and track and field. It's all you need.
Yep. The three T, two T's and a TAF, apparently.
Yeah, nerve, moxie, chutzpah, courage, guts, hubris.
Came in prepared.
Thanks for buying me time,
nice.
You too.
I heard you tick-tacking away. <You're> just
or if I'm, let's do four. Rootin', tootin', pointin', shootin'.
Oh, nice.
I like that. I like
feels
that.
A little bit like it comes from the, it feels like it comes a little bit from the lasers and feelings school of, of stats. You have four stats. Rootin', tootin'. Pointing and shooting.
I'm going to make the most American RPG of all time.
Well, speaking of American things, an American movie I was very fortunate to see a pre-release of just yesterday of the D&D movie Honor Among Thieves.
Me too.
Did you really?
I did. And it was an accident. I saw people talking about it on Twitter and saying, oh, I enjoyed it. I thought, I didn't realize it was out yet. I can't believe Australia cares this little about D&D. And I looked up a showtime and it seemed to be running, and I invited friends and we went to see it yesterday, and then I realized it was the only showing until the end of the month.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah, that is exactly what happened to us as well. Is we went to look for showtimes for the end of the month for like opening weekend, and it was like, wait a minute, this says there's like a time here on the public holiday. Let's just go to that one instead, like 2 weeks early. So,
was it a public holiday?
Was it not Labor Day in the New South Wales? People not have Labor Day?
I don't know, man. I work for myself.
James, Sean, have either of you been fortunate enough to get to a pre-screening?
No, I was attending the Critical Role anniversary party.
I heard it was pre-releasing in Australia, so I tried to swim, but I'm not a strong swimmer. So I didn't make it very far.
Half this podcast not seen it yet, but I would deign to guess most of our viewers. Spoiler-free, Dale, out of 10 or out of 5 stars, what are you giving it?
Ooh, out of 10, I'm going to give it like 7 or an 8. I had a fun time. You know, there are some tweaks I would maybe make, but I had a good time. Yeah. And I think that, you know, as much as the people who were mad about the owlbear are going to be so much more mad, they're going to be spewing. But if you're going there with a mind to have just a fun time, I think you're going to have a fun time.
I would concur. I would agree. 7 out of 10, 3.5 stars, probably 3 stars if I wasn't allowed to give halves. But a solid, entertaining time. The one thing I will say is that it is a movie that has not an original bone in its body, and yet that is kind of D&D, which is like, oh, I like that. I'm going to take that and put it in my campaign. So there you go.
The one thing I do want to say is that before I went, I was chatting to my sister, and I was explaining the owlbear controversy. And she was clearly new to the concept of owlbears, and I tried to explain it. It was one of those things where she wasn't, it's not like she didn't care, but she also definitely didn't care. And then I got home from the movie, and she was being good, and she was engaging with me. And she said, how were the goose cats? Because she knew it was something she was reaching for. She's like, there's a bird and a mammal. Stick them together.
I love goose cats.
Yeah. Yeah. This is from the same sister who recently forgot the phrase dark horse and replaced it with both the dog you don't notice and the sheep that comes from behind.
Now that's horse of a different color. Uh-huh. Dale, can we make the goose cat? Can we just like,
please,
next weekend, just like slap that in Google Doc, throw it on Twitter?
100%. Please.
When do we start the goose cat Kickstarter? I need to know. I got to start writing.
We're going to have plushes. We're going to have minis.
Goose cat, the board game, the goosening.
You know, when we did Tell Dory Reborn with Critical Role, there's a monster in the cover called the Adranak that's this like astral sphinx sort of winged feline construct creature. And like WizKids made a mini of it. I love this creature. Focus on it. Focus on it. Whatever. Made this creature. And my co-authors and I have been saying the entire time, we need plushes of it. We need plushes of this little guy. And those bastards won't listen to us. Damn them. RPG plushies, monster plushies are the way to go. And Ben, maybe I'm segueing for you, but Wizard seems to have realized this. Have y'all been seeing the mimic plushies, the displacer beast plushies, all of that have been coming out kind of in support of the movie? Mm-hmm. They're really cute.
That mimic is adorable.
I think we will see a lot more plushies based on this movie in the near future. The one thing, actually, that I am disappointed about that got shown in the trailer was the mimic, speaking of.
Hmm.
The fact that the mimic box opened up and its tongue shoots out, blah, 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 blah. If that hadn't been shown in the trailer and nobody knew that was coming, that would have caused the theater to explode. That's the one thing that I wish they had held back for the surprise for people
I would
to see.
Agree with that.
Yeah, I respect that.
Speaking of things that the community will have opinions about, Wizards of the Coast released a community update with a sort of laundry list. They were just basically putting their Monday board to-do list out to the public, it seemed, which is great, cool, with a whole laundry list of things that they have both done, planned to do, and are doing currently.
You know what? Good for them. Good for them for trying to now be a little bit more transparent and engage with the community a little bit more and, you know, do the things that the fans may be interested in. Yes, you're opening yourself up to be ridiculed and Well, so are we by sitting here doing this. So, you know, good for them. And I'd love to see more of that. And it looks like there are going to be a little bit more public facing, at least with their, you know, with what they're working on.
This is something that D&D Beyond did very well, is by making a publicly visible Trello board that had their short term, midterm, and, you know, very long term, if ever, plans kind of up there for the community to see. And I get the sense that Wizards did not inherit this concept from them. I don't think that, you know, their leadership got imported into Wizards decision-making hierarchies, echelons, or anything like that. But it just goes to show that being transparent earns you a lot of goodwill with fans, especially when maybe you've done something that, you know, perhaps wants you to earn some goodwill back.
They're definitely on that earn the goodwill back kind of train, journey, if you will, still.
Tour.
Yeah. If we drill down into these a little bit more, I mean, the done section is the SRD 5.1 is now in Creative Commons. The 1D&D playtest packet has been releasing. I love
including a done list.
Yeah, I know. It is very like, yeah, we know. We were there. We saw that.
To be fair, I mean, when I'm making a checklist of stuff that I want to do, I do also include things that I've already achieved. That's just fair. To make me feel better.
Yeah.
And hey, maybe this is to make the community feel better. I mean, maybe. Of course it is.
With the poor communication sometimes, people might not know some of these things have been done. So it can be very helpful to when you have a million users or 10 million users, as opposed to, you know, a company that might have 50 users for their product. It's good to get that information out there.
You know, I will say this, maybe this is just my own personal axe to grind, but with social media starting to diffuse as it is, right? We had kind of a big bang at the beginning of the internet, then everything coalesced into three social media platforms, and things are starting to big bang out again. I have no idea where to find news for the things I like anymore. Marvel Snap is a huge offender for this, where it's like, I'm not on their Discord. Where do I learn about things? Do
the Discord is the only place they post that stuff. Sometimes people repost to Reddit. That's it. That's all you got.
And then Reddit trickles onto Twitter sometimes. And that's where I learn things. But D&D suffers kind of the same fate. Twitter is not what it used to be. Certainly D&D Twitter is not what it used to be. D&D Facebook was, if you'll forgive me, never what it used to be. And so the official D&D website was also never a hub. And so I kind of wish we knew where to look, other than kind of having it trickle into our periphery.
Well, I've got good news for you, James, because there is a tabletop news program which is coming. If you listen to last week's episode of the Eldritch Lorecast, you will learn all about it. But I think that they're definitely trying to posit D&D Beyond as being that place to learn about what's going on in the D&D community specifically. They talked in this update that we will have more updates coming. We don't want to say that there's like a specific pace at which updates will be released, but more of them will be on their way. So keep an eye on the D&D Beyond. That said, it's not easy to find on their website, because I went to find this article again. I went to D&D Beyond. I could not find it, so I had to Google D&D Beyond community update to get a direct link to the page.
Classic. It's like navigating a university website. You have to go to Google.
The in-progress stuff that they have listed sort of caught me a little bit by surprise. And am I mistaken in recalling that this was something that was asked for when Kyle Brink was doing his apology tour, which was localization of the 5.1 SRD into French, Italian, German, and Spanish? Was that something that was brought up during that time?
It was. It was brought up by Teo Sabadia, of all people, who has been trying to get Wizards of the Coast and the various organizations that work through them to support the other languages, especially Spanish. Him being a Colombian American, to try to reach that community. And Kyle did say, yes, that is something that is on our to-do list. And they were talking about the books They were talking about a player's handbook, a localized player's handbook, Monster Manual, DMG. And here it's the SRD, which is moving in the right direction. It's not quite the same, but yeah.
This is a really fascinating dimension to this story, too, because you may think in the back of your mind, hasn't this already happened? Didn't this happen already? And indeed it did for many European languages. Gale Force 9 did localize the player's handbook and maybe some of the other core books as well. But curiously, its Spanish edition was European Spanish, continental Spanish, Latin American Spanish, despite being, I believe, the more populous language worldwide, and certainly closer to home for American company Wizards of the Coast, never even received a hint of localization. And that is the gong that Taos has been banging for literal years, right, trying to get this to happen.
And the major problem with that was, since the books were being made in Spain, you would have to import them. Yeah. Now, the cost of things in Europe is much, much different than the cost of things in Latin and Central and South America, to the point where you would have to spend a year's salary to buy the books.
They are reviewing previous editions for inclusion in the Creative Commons, meaning previous SRDs, I assume, for 3, 3.5, other previous editions that had an SRD. I don't assume 4th, because 4th didn't have an SRD, did it? Publish an internal content policy for D&D products. So make public facing their content policy. I'm assuming this is sort of around ensuring that the books are adequately inclusive, that there is not problematic content within the books. I think that's sort of where that's leaning. So wanting to be a bit more transparent with the community in terms of what they are doing to improve that sort of content within their books. Mm-hmm. And then the update to the D&D core books is in progress, which is 6th, as far as we know, which they continue to work on.
Don't you think that language is interesting? The update to the core books has kind of been the prevailing verbiage that they are using for what is one D&D.
Mm.
It seems to be a way of dissuading us from thinking about 6th edition.
Well, that's interesting when you look at their upcoming, which is to ensure one D&D rules updates are compatible with 5th edition and the SRD. And that's a curious thing to have in their upcoming list because, I mean, I don't know, maybe that upcoming should be entitled ongoing, because you assume that's what they've been working on doing this entire time. But maybe they're receiving feedback that suggests to them, which I think we've said on this podcast a few times, these classes don't seem quite as backwards compatible as we may have first been led to believe. And sure, you could have a 1D&D cleric or a 1D&D paladin in the same party as a 5E rogue or a 5E ranger, but you can't take a Xanathar's Guide to Everything subclass for a paladin with a 1D&D paladin. I don't know if that specific example is true, but they've changed like where the subclass levels kind of sit between the different classes and kind of standardized that across the board a bit more, which means that it's not like technically, yes, practically, you know, a bit hinky in the tinkering there.
Mm-hmm. I see what you did. I'm just sticking a pin in this for in a couple of weeks' time when we can start talking about the D&D movie. But I am interested to talk about the comparison between the D&D movie and the class design direction of one D&D. That's right. All I'm going to say.
Yeah, okay.
Horrible Cabbage brings up an interesting point. If there are new versions of the core books, and the core books are what define an edition of the game, what makes updated core books not an edition? Who can say? Those of us who lived through and played through the third edition of D&D certainly have some experience with that. The differences between the third edition 3.0 core books and the 3.5 core books were once kind of substantial and not very substantial. They sure changed everything, but it sure didn't change the fundamental identity of what third edition was. And I have a hunch that the rules refresh for 5th edition will be much the same.
It also makes me think of wargaming when they, you know, release errata to change a bunch of the mechanics. I don't war game. I don't know if I'm using the right words, but when they're like, let's release a new thing that changes everything that we released last time. That thing.
Yeah, no, you use the right word.
Great.
I'm praying that someone at Wizards is thinking ahead to the conversations that poor gamers are going to have when new books come out. And you're trying to set up a game. You go to a game store, you go to a convention, you're looking for players for your home game. Try to think of what that conversation is going to sound like. And whether it's through marketing or through development or business, whatever, please, Wizards, think of these people and what they're going to have to go through to get a game together. You want to make that
only core classes. What does that mean?
As simple as possible. So it's not, so are we playing fifth edition or one D&D or what is it? Is it 5.5? Is it 6e? We need to nip that in the bud right now.
Updated 5e.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. It needs to be able to be talked about smoothly if you want more and more people playing your game.
I would think, and this is purely a Bender speculation here, but I would think that what Wizards would want to do is release their core books again and kind of have them as basically, apart from what Jeremy Crawford occasionally tweets, like set in stone. Those are the core books as written. Those are the rules which everything will like reference back to. But I can definitely imagine this nightmare scenario, a Games Workshop type solution, if you will, to dip back into the war games, which is here is the rule book, and 6 months later, here is the rulebook 0.5 with all the changes to the rules that we have made in the last 6 months. And then 6 months later, here is the newest rulebook. And I can see that being the case specifically because of this push towards D&D Beyond and their virtual tabletop, just deciding this ability needs a slight reword. This needs a slight rebalance.
They can update on the fly more than exactly. They ever have been able to. Yeah,
exactly. Let's just push it through
Speaking
on the fly.
Speaking of second dinner in Marvel Snap. Sorry.
A new D&D hotfix has just been pushed live. I mean, they tried to do this in 4th edition and people got very, very mad about it. As people did with just about everything 4th edition. They got very, very mad on the internet about it. The common complaint about the 4th edition player's handbook was that it was more errata pages than published pages by the end of the edition's life, because everything kind of got tweaked and futzed with, because that was a very sort of numerical balance dependent edition. That was the point of the edition. I do wonder though, if perhaps they were just ahead of their time there. Fourth edition was in many ways was very ahead of its time. It really wanted to go all in on digital tools, and mishap after mishap after mishap. Go watch our Matt Colville episode, right? Mishap after mishap after mishap just gutted the vision for fourth edition. And when you look at what was intended, the technology that was supposed to be there to support that game, a lot of the things that seem kind of janky about fourth edition make so much sense. And we live in a world now where I think that might be possible, where the digital version of the game is the core version of the game, and the books are kind of this stylish collector's edition of the game.
See, the thing with that is I think that we're in an age where we're fully capable of that. It's definitely possible. But I think as long as we're calling them pen and paper RPGs or tabletop RPGs, it will always feel like something that has to, at its center, be about being in person. And something like 4th edition, you know, playing Dusk with Colville, it's really fun. It works great on the virtual tabletop. And there was a lot of, oh, wow, 4th edition is great. What was all this about? And I had to stop and sit back and remember, okay, but if you're sitting there playing at the table, trying to remember all these powers, remember which ones you've activated, which ones you haven't activated, you're ending up with like a folder's worth of stuff for your character. I think there's going to be a lot of great stuff that comes out of digital tabletop gaming. but I think that there's so much nostalgia tied up in this game that it's going to be really hard to move like the majority of the player base to purely online.
Is the Rules Refresh going to be a tabletop game? Is
that's
that what
the question?
Want?
That's the question.
Or will there just be some strange old holdouts like us who will continue to play it as a tabletop game?
I don't think we're that uncommon. That's no. all. I just no, don't, I don't think we're so. That uncommon.
I don't think so either. But I can see how a marketing
every
exec
every edition
might get
of D&D, the most common customer base is people who already play D&D. You know what I mean? Like, we're only just now entering an age where you're getting a lot of people who don't play D&D buying D&D. That's new. Mm-hmm. That's a new phenomena. Mm-hmm. And I think still most D&D customers are people who bought the previous edition and are moving on to the next one.
It's not even maybe the previous edition, but maybe the edition before the previous edition.
Yeah.
which is a whole new way to look at this issue of who's going to be buying the next edition. Is it going to be just the same old players? Is it going to be people who watch the movie who have no idea what D&D actually is, except for the funky stuff happening up on the screen? And how are we going to invite them gently into this hobby of ours?
I can't wait to talk about this with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so,
we might have to do
the Americans, we're all going to see it opening night, right? We're going to go.
If you are an Amazon Prime member, you can get tickets for a special showing Sunday, March 19th.
This podcast not sponsored by Amazon Prime.
at 2 p.m. Although we would take your money. At 2 p.m., you can get
however,
a special
if you
showing.
Want to use your Twitch Prime sub to subscribe to Ghostfire.
On Twitch, yes, that would be great.
Right. So in the U.S., you can see it a week early. At 2 p.m. on Sunday, you have to buy tickets via the previously aforementioned site.
Yeah, give us some of them Bezos bucks. The D&D Content Creator Summit. Speaking of much to talk about and yet maybe not that much to talk about, I don't know. This has kind of blown up to I saw Bob Worldbuilder's video, as everybody did, with the very deliberately constructed, very clickbaity thumbnail and title of the video. And that's not a criticism of Bob. If anything, that's a congratulations. Like, Bob is good at YouTube, right? Of course he is. He's been successful. And it kind of, I think that video specifically is why this blew up into a thing. And then I read Taos's blog article on the matter, and I sort of settled down a little bit. Because Taos basically, to summarize in Ben's words, Taos's blog article was like, they did this for 5th edition too. Yeah, they do this all the time. They invite journalists out or, you know, that's been the word that's getting people angry is journalists in this current discussion. But they invite people who are part of the community, voices in the community, if you will, out, and they showcase what they're working on. And that's something that has happened before and something that I assume will continue to happen. But I think largely because of Bob's YouTubeizing of this discussion, it has turned more contentious.
That's been a theme in recent times.
I thought it was the content creator definition that got people the most angry. Maybe that's just coming from a game development side. But, you know, I had people who have written for Wizards of the Coast on multiple books who have still never gotten to meet anybody in person at Wizards of the Coast, never been invited to Wizards of the Coast. And so seeing the word content creator, the RPG design community said, what is it that I'm doing am I not creating content for role-playing games?
This is something that I really saw the inside of when D&D Live was happening for Waterdeep and Avernus in 2018 and 2019, because I wrote for Avernus, but I was only invited to that event because I was working in a journalistic capacity for D&D Beyond. And like Dale, I mean, you and I did stuff together there. We were a part of the event, but I was not there because I was a writer. I kind of weaseled my way into that through the back channels of journalism, which is which feels wrong for me to say it because I love good journalism. My dad's a journalist, right? I deeply respect people like Linda Codiga, who broke the SRD, the OGL news way back when. And fascinating enough, they have been
way back when
up.
It was like 3 weeks ago, James.
Yeah. 3 years ago, right? I mean, it felt like
come
it.
On, Dale, don't joke around. know how time works.
I was at that same event again. I worked on the book as well, but I was not invited as a writer. I was invited as someone who wrote the game event that was playing there. And I got there and I was so excited. I got my badge and I put my badge on and I looked down and I look at everyone else. It's talent, 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 talent on everyone's badge, you know, around the dressing rooms and around the tables. And I look at mine and it says staff. And I'm like, I am
so
now
rude.
In Hollywood. I am in Hollywood. And I feel bad for complaining because this must
well,
be what
Sean,
writers
in
Hollywood
feel like.
Well,
Sean, you're only
talented
if you're in front of the camera.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, thank goodness I have a camera now. Look at my talent. yeah, I mean, it's the way the industry is, right? It's the way the industry has always been. And
I also need people to understand what a shambles that was because I was invited and I was invited to do like my own sort of unit of time in one of the sort of streaming booths and to host a
thing. This was the Avernus thing you're talking about, yeah. Dale, just to clarify.
Yeah. And I was invited to do that and I pitched a bunch of ideas and then they got back to me and they were like, we invited too many people. If you want, you can bring a camera and stand in the corner. And I had to weasel my way into, cause I, you know, bought plane tickets and stuff. So it was just so that everyone's fully on the same page about what a shambles it was.
But were you talent?
I was talent. I think I've got my badge somewhere. Over there.
Inevitably, it's always a shambles, really. In fact, despite the controversy, this one may be the least shambles of all.
Yeah. I just like,
everyone's angry they finally got their shit together.
Yeah. It's important that people understand that I don't think that there's necessarily that much thought going into who gets an invite and who doesn't. I think that it's kind of a free for all. Anyway. Mm-hmm.
If you did get an invitation, great. Congratulations.
That's awesome.
Awesome. Go enjoy yourself. Don't listen to the people who are upset at you or who are calling you a sellout because you do a thing that adds value to this community. Go add value to this community in whatever way you can.
And imagine being
God
called
bless.
A sellout because you're you know, working in the D&D tabletop industry and you get invited to a D&D event. That's I'm sorry that this is happening. You know what else it reminds me of? It's when you get those marketing things where they just send out like a fancy package to different people and not everyone gets a fancy package. And it's sad to not get a fancy package, but it's I don't think it speaks to your value as an individual.
I think that's what this happened too soon after Glass Onion. And so that's what everybody's kind of seeing is the parallels to Glass Onion. Did Bob Worldbuilder have to solve a puzzle to open the email to be able to access this? But to Sean's point, that's what legitimately made me crack up laughing from Bob's video was when he was like, you guys will say that, like, you know, they're just trying to wine and dine you. I'm happy to be wined and dined. Like, of course I'm going to take this trip. I'd be mad not to take this trip out there. So yeah, I don't know. We'll you can see that Wizards are trying to be transparent here, that they're trying to be transparent to the public, that this is still trying to be a very like, oh, we're just part of the community and we want to invite the community in kind of
also
attitude.
The best way to disseminate information to the community is via the people who have a lot of,
for sure.
A good megaphone.
Yeah.
A lot has been made.
Content marketing. That's the way of the 21st century, baby.
A lot have been making a point about how, though, like Wizards don't have NDAs on this. And they're like, we're not going to make you sign an NDA because that's a poison word after what happened with the OGL debacle. There's no pressure to create content. You don't have to say anything. Of course, they're going to make content and say stuff because that's how they make a living. So you can see that Wizards are trying to position this as a community outreach sort of situation. I had a larger point that I was coming to, and I completely forgot it in those words. So I'm just going to leave it there.
Yeah,
I
don't know.
Is our headline community outreach or community outrage? Wizards. Oh.
You really are a journalist.
It all paid off, Dad. It all paid off. The thing that really fascinates me about this is the way that micro celebrity hero worship pedestal placing plays into all of this, because I was talking about Linda Codega, the journalist for, I think, Gizmodo, who broke the OGL news back in January. They have taken a very strong stance on this. They are one of the kind of leading figures to broach the topic of maybe the people who are accepting this invite are sellouts. They are doing damage control for Wizards. And that has sparked a lot of sort of ire in return. And it's really a microcosm of how in this world of micro celebrity that I feel like all of Twitter, but D&D Twitter included, has kind of more and more gravitated to becoming. You can be on top of the world one day. You can be a champion of the people one day. And one bad take, doesn't have to be a bad take, one take that people interpret badly, you are scum. You've been cast down. And this isn't even a cancel culture thing, right? I don't believe in cancel culture, but I do believe in the fickle nature of people's opinion. And the more and more we prioritize that as social currency, the more and more you will see this happen. That is the cost of influencer marketing, right? That is the cost of, you know, parasocially forming bonds with people. Whether you're a big company like Wizards or an independent journalist like Lynn Codega, you are inviting this upon yourself, and that is the name of the game. And so it's why I kind of hate freelancing, because you got to do that. You got to brand yourself. Just enter that area of personal branding with care.
Is it April 2nd? I actually don't think I wrote it down.
It's the beginning of April, yes.
Speaking of which as well, I don't think I put it on the run sheet. Sorry, going off script for a moment here, was that Wizards did say in that community update that they've got a D&D Direct, I think, coming in March. Hopefully on a Monday, but probably on a Tuesday. So we shall cross our fingers.
It's funny because that's their big... I was more excited about the events than the rest of this, because Wizards has this pendulum of close engagement with the community through outreach, through conventions, through game days at local gaming stores, and then nothing. And now it looks like we're hitting that side of the pendulum where they're doing things like family friendly, build an e-community together, join your local game store in inviting kids to the D&D table with exclusive kits for family play. They have three events like this over this year where they're sending content directly to Wizards Play Network stores, i.e. places where people gather to play Magic, and giving out for free game stuff, bringing in people to help run games. That's huge. That's where we get to the rising tide theory, where we have people who wouldn't be playing otherwise coming into an actual game store where there are things up on the shelves that they might buy, as opposed to sitting at home and being given things through D&D Beyond. This is what I want Wizards to do. I want them to create these opportunities, these special events that people write down on their calendars and say, oh, I can't wait to go run new players through this if I'm a volunteer, or play or take my kids if I'm an old school player who is getting back into the game. This is what I want to see from Wizards, getting out to conventions and running things. And I'm seeing that on this list. That gets my little heart going pitter-patter.
I wonder how much the pandemic spoiled that runaway train of goodwill Wizards had with 5e going into 2020. Because if we had never had to shut ourselves in and isolate, and, you know, we'd got another D&D Live in 2020 instead of D&D Celebration or whatever the online event was called, it feels like it's restarting right now. But if that momentum had continued unabated, I wonder if we would ever have had this whole OGL crisis. if we would have had a Wizards that needs to, you know, kind of struggle to get the community goodwill back instead of, you know, continuing to build it.
Well, that's interesting because actually, because with those events mid-COVID that were fully digital, it felt like Wizards of the Coast really went, wait, we can just get all celebrities because the investment is so small. It's really easy to do that. And it felt a little bit like, you know, sort of late stage tabletop on Geek and Sundry where it's literally just like, let's just get famous people and it doesn't matter if there's any connection with the community. It felt a little bit like that. So I'm stoked to have more of this, like actually getting out to the people.
At the start of COVID, Wizards did a lot of outreach in giving away free products. I know because my product was one that they gave away for free. It had sold 10,000 copies on the DMs Guild. It was downloaded over 100,000 times when it was given away for free.
Man.
Yeah. Holy moly.
Exactly. So there are at least 100,000 people out there who are scarred for life, but hey, thank you. thank you for looking at my stuff. But, you know, they were trying. I think they were trying. And, you know, the OGL may have come from partially because of the pandemic and shutdowns, because their revenue went up because people were staying home. And that revenue going up, what happened? Hasbro went, look at that revenue going up while ours is going down. What do we have to do to get that? Oh, let's write a new gaming license. So I think you were right, James. It might not have been exactly the reason why, but I think it's all tied together. The historians will go back and look and see how one thing led to another.
You used the wrong formula, but somehow got the right answer. That was exactly my entire high school calculus experience. Yes. Yeah.
Well, speaking of things happening in the community, quick shout out to Journeys Through the Radiant Citadel, which has been nominated for a Nebula Sci-Fi Award for the writing in the game category, I suppose. And it's interesting to me, because I've never had my ear to the ground with the Nebulas, but it's interesting to me that the category is both digital and tabletop gaming going up against each other, because Journeys Through the Radiant Citadel is up against the likes of Elden Ring, Pentiment, Stray, and also Vampire the Masquerade, Sins of the Sirens, which I assume is a tabletop product.
What an eclectic bunch of products.
And that's not even all of the nominees. It is eclectic indeed.
Yeah, it really feels apples and oranges. It kind of highlights the enormity of the difference between tabletop games and digital games, doesn't it? Mm. Surely the mainstream audience doesn't care. They're like, yeah, they're games.
I suppose so.
Do only people like us care about this? I ask myself that question every day.
I ask myself that every time there's Twitter drama.
Yeah. only weird nerds care about that specifically. Congratulations to Journeys Through the Radiant Citadel. We shall cross our fingers for you to pull out the victory. Speaking of victories, Valakan Clans, the Kickstarter is in its final days. It is approaching the finish line. So I think at this point of recording, it's like 4 days. If you're listening to this on YouTube, it's probably only another 2 days, or on Spotify for that matter, or iTunes, or wherever you find your podcasts. So go check it out. It's an awesome Viking-inspired, grim, hollow adventure plus supplement book worked on by your hosts, Sean Merwin, James Hake. How are you two feeling as we come into the final stretch?
Thrilled and just like eager for those final stretch goals to be passed. I don't even want to say final because they're the revealed stretch goals, ones that are tantalizing you right now, because the stuff that they've got up is really, really cool. I think the last one we passed was a fabric map of Ragvald Village, the home village in the adventure. I don't know why the fabric map is so like meaningful to me, but I remember when I was a kid, I was playing Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess. The collector's edition of that game or the strategy guide or something came with a fabric map of Hyrule. And I loved that thing. I had it on my wall. So fabric maps have a real deep place in my heart. But this one, unlike that purely decorative one from when I was a kid, this one is very, very useful. I like the village is central to that adventure. Mm. And so having an actual physical map that all of these backers get will elevate the play experience in a really wonderful way.
I think that this is probably the best Grim Hollow supplement, the best Grim Hollow product we've made. Mm. And I don't even think it's close. And so I really want to, I want people to see it. I want people to look at what the future of Grim Hollow could be. If that's what the, you know, if that's what our fans want, if that's what the playing community wants, because between, you know, the rules and the adventure that James worked on and all our freelancers who built this beautiful story and, you know, Simon Sherry and his team putting together these products that are absolutely astounding. I want people to see them. I want people to have them and realize that we could be doing this all over Grim Hollow. And I want to do that. So I just in my bones, I want people to see it, to get that big box of goodies, you know, when it fulfills and open it like it's Christmas.
Next stretch goal is really cool. The one that we're not even kind of like within striking distance of yet that I really want to happen, because it's one of the subclasses that Sean, you and your team did, the Mammoth Hunter Fighter. Because as much as I love
the
Mammoth Hunter Fighter,
that sounds sick.
Yeah, it's very baked into the like the lore of the world, and I think that's what certainly in this stage of fifth edition, where it's kind of long in the tooth and a lot of the sort of fundamental aspects of class fantasy have been explored. You got to dig into the thing that's really specifically cool about this setting that makes it very specific and extremely Valakan. And I don't know, you plunder it for your non-Valakan Viking themed game too, of course, or your Icewind Dale game or whatever. But we made this for Valakan clans, and that's what's cool about it.
Yeah, go check it out. There was a link in the chat. There will be links everywhere. Over my left shoulder, there's a link up in that corner. If you're watching this on YouTube, and if you're watching it on Spotify or something like that, it'll be down in the show notes. Speaking of this podcast, though, you can send emails to us at podcast@ghostfiregaming.com. And we will take those emails and we will read them out on this podcast. And we will answer the questions posited to us in these emails, such as this one from Josh, who is feeling like he had a big climactic encounter. I know that this is a topic that can kind of, it can be a little incendiary within the tabletop RPG community, within the D&D community, about like planning out your climactic, in quotation marks, boss battle. And Josh felt that they had pulled their punches a little bit in the final boss battle. They feel like they didn't go for the, like the second stage of the fight. They just had the boss die at the end of the first stage of the fight. And at the end of it, his party commented, or someone in the party commented, that they felt that the boss was easier than they were expecting. They were like, oh, well, that wasn't as much of a challenge as I thought it would be, which was a dagger in Josh's heart. Felt like he didn't quite, his words literally, didn't feel like that he had quite lived up to his player's expectation of a climactic battle. Advice for running climactic battles that are satisfyingly tough, but not accidentally overtuned and deadly, which is what I tend to do.
It's hard. It's a really difficult thing to do. The only advice I have, and it can be tricky to implement, so I apologize in advance, is to really, ahead of a combat design, think what stakes are you willing to put on the table? Is this the finale? Does that mean that you are willing to risk a party wipe? You know what I mean? Like, would it still be a satisfying ending if the entire party dies? Do you want people to go down but not die? Do you want one or two players to have their characters die? The tricky thing really comes, in my opinion, because you can like stack the deck in favor of the bad guy. Overtuning, I think, isn't the worst thing in the world because you can pull back. I think the danger does come from the fact that you like these characters and you like your players and you do want to pull the punches. You don't want to see them sad. But I think, okay, unless you're Ben. And then you really want everyone to cry. But, you know, it's I think, a question of deciding ahead of time what risk are you willing to take here? Like, what is the worst thing that can happen that you are willing to let happen, and then commit to that course of action? But it can be really difficult to do. So I don't know if I have any like actual good advice. Sean, do you have actual good advice?
I have actual advice. Good. We'll leave that up to the experts. So my first answer to almost every question we get about DMing is, what do your players want? And if you don't know, ask your players what your players want. And that will help guide you. So you know if they don't mind if there is a party wipe, or that they will be very sad if there is. With that said, when I saw the question in our show notes, Ben had left out something that the actual question had, which was, I had a two-tiered combat planned, but I jettisoned that after the first tier because it had taken 2 hours. So my thing is, why didn't you run the second tier? Unless you were out of time, put that second tier out there. See what happens. These epic fights, one of the things that makes fights epic is that they aren't like the other fights that you've had. So if you're always running three-tiered fights, then a three-tiered fight is not going to do much. But if your fights are normally three rounds and we've defeated all the monsters, then this having waves come is great. Not only because it sort of changes the scope of things, but you can always stop a wave if you know that the next wave is going to be too much. And you know your players don't want that. The other thing is change everything during the combat. Change the setting. It started in this room. This room is now volcanic and the floor is falling away. That can be just as epic as any sort of monsters you can add. So always be thinking of ways to change the setting. Change the goals of the combat. You thought the goal was going to be stop the ritual, but the real goal is actually now get out of this room because everything's falling around and this stone just falls and crushes this big bad guy that you thought was the villain. And now escape is the climactic battle while you're fighting other things as you leave. The more you can change from expectations from the start of the battle to the end of the battle, the more epic it's going to feel. And you don't have to do any sort of just keep throwing monsters at them if you do that. The last thing is, if you make the villain, the main villain, the hardest part of the battle, you've already lost, because that's what everyone expects. And they're just going to focus fire on that main villain and, okay, we killed him, now what? The villain should be important, but other things should be just as dangerous as the villain that the characters have to contend with. And so if you have your evil wizard, then the dragon behind the evil wizard, who is its assistant or who it summoned, is actually going to be the main threat. Now your players are guessing, which is more important to go after? We're not sure. We thought it was this villain who we've been chasing for 7, 8, 9, 10 levels. But this dragon looks pretty tough. What do we do? And then you can take your time and slow things down and let your players soak in that epicness and talk with each other and suss out what they think, because that adds to the epicness of the feel of the battle going on around them.
Sean, the point you brought up about the timing of game sessions really resonated with me, because it made me think about what inspires me when I'm making big boss fights like that. Video games, yeah, I think that's where the multi-tier boss fight really got its teeth from in TTRPGs. But from a dramatic standpoint, right, because this is always a game and story double question when we're talking about stuff like this, story-wise, I'm always inspired by the shonen anime I watched as a kid. Things like Dragon Ball.
I was
going to
say anime.
And Yu-Gi-Oh! And those shows are not afraid to spend 5 episodes on their climactic card game or their climactic boss battle. And if you think about each session as an episode with its own sort of arc of drama within it, the boss being impaled by the lance of light that your cleric summoned and then boom, crashes down, but then its carapace cracks open and its second winged form crawls out. I mean, that's a great cliffhanger to end a session on. And your players, I suspect, will not feel like they have suddenly, you know, been having an 8-hour slog of a boss fight. They will feel like they've had one or two or three distinct chunks of drama that they've just played through.
How many Dragon Ball characters does it take to change a light bulb?
How many, Dale?
Just one, but it'll take 9 episodes.
Yeah, absolutely. The other aspect of this that I want to talk about is, Josh, forgive yourself. This is a game. And the most significant part of the fact that this is a game is that you're the only one who's running it. You're the only one who's playtested it. You are playtesting and delivering live the game all at the exact same time. So if you're playing this game strictly by the rules, any number of things could go wrong that you could not have anticipated. You don't have the benefit of a bunch of different people trying to stress test this encounter. And so any number of bizarre exploits could absolutely throw it in the bin. And players could feel like, oh, that was way too easy. It was just this thing that we did. My suggestion often is to forget about the game aspect and focus on the drama of it. Focus on, you know, fudge the numbers behind the screen. Don't worry about it. Because if what you feel bad about at the end of the day is the player's thinking, well, that wasn't very satisfying, then you're not worry less about the game and worry more about the experience and how to craft it in a way that feels exciting, but may not be 100% legit.
Yeah. The emergent storytelling that comes with a game like this can be incredible. It can be the best thing in the world, but also it can fall flat. The dice don't know the difference, right? Good Rain knows when to fall. D&D dice, they're a little iffy. But you know what? Here's some advice that I can give from my Christmas one shot. If your big climactic battle is falling flat, the dice just aren't working in your favor. Look, when in doubt, threaten to tear a character's arms off. It'll spice things up. They'll probably kill the bad guy before then, but it'll make it feel more dramatic when they do.
I had to tear a character's arm off as like penance for getting through a boss fight that went bad for the party. They were fighting against a frost giant and it was not going to go their way. This was looking like a TPK. So they're like, can we bargain? And the frost giant was like, yeah, sure. I'll take his arm in recompense for letting you pass. And that was the end of it. The other thing is, I agree with Sean. Don't feel bad for changing things. Change the add 20 hit points to the boss. Take 20 hit points away if you have to. At the same time, something that I'm trying to learn is to not behind the screen counter my player's clever play, because I had an instinct to do that previously where they would come up with an idea and I would in my head think, oh no, they're just going to tear this boss apart now. Okay, what can I do to kind of like counter that so that it doesn't just turn into a bit of a wet fart of an encounter? But not doing that can also make your players, and again, it's about talking with your players and trying to figure out what they want out of the game. But recently, they knew they were going up against a bunch of spellcasters, so they decided to cast Fog Cloud, which meant that the spellcasters couldn't see any target to cast a spell at, and they slaughtered them. And it was glorious, you know. It was, you know, the reputation of these spellcasters had been built up for a little while. But the fact that they clever planned it out, you know, was it wasn't as epic as it necessarily needed to be, but it was still satisfying in a different way. So
a lesson to those spellcasters to prepare Gust next time.
Yeah, exactly. Or dispel magic.
Yeah.
Or Misty Step when they got grappled, you know, two turns later. That it was a slaughter. Anyway, speaking of slaughters, we have slaughtered through the time here. and reached the end of this episode of the Eldritch Lorecast. If you are watching this on YouTube, feel free to subscribe to the channel. If you're watching it through an audio platform, feel free to leave us a review if that is possible. I'm pretty sure it is on Spotify and iTunes and all those places. Thank you, Twitch chat, for joining us for this episode. I've been Ben Byrne here with Dale Kingsmill, Sean Merwin, James Hake, and we will be back next week with another episode of the Eldritch Lorecast.